This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, we've got a great Dreamland for you today. First, we're starting off with John Sumple, who directed an incredible, beautiful documentary about abductees called The Seeding. And it is really, actually a good job. Can you believe it? No, I couldn't either, frankly, but it is. It's very well done. And we're going to be talking to him about the documentary and why he did it and why he decided to treat us seriously, which is a big step forward, in my opinion. You don't see much of that, not at a high level of finish like this documentary. But then afterwards, we're going back to Denisovan origins with Greg Little talking about the Americas and what actually happened here and why this mystery is so important. And this is important to me, and I will tell you why. You know a little bit about it already, some of you, but a few weeks ago on the Pine Ridge Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, I had the most powerful experience of my life. It is going to be featured in my new book, A New World. But I want to talk just a little bit about it right now. What happened basically was when I closed my eyes, when I was on that reservation at a conference, I would see another world. Not in glimpses, but for hours in great detail. I could look down at, say, at a roadside or a patch of grass or something and close my eyes and see another version of the same thing in extraordinary detail. I could count the petals on flowers, but when I opened my eyes, it wasn't the same world. Now, I'm unbelievable, right? This went on for 3 days. Okay, so we're going to talk about Denisovan origins in the Americas with Greg Little and about the power in this land in the Americas. And boy, does that mean a lot to me. But first, we're going to be talking to John Sumple, which in this also means a great deal to me because we close encounter witnesses and abductees get shafted all the time. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, some Comedy Central show wanted to do a thing with me about rectal probes again after all these years. Don't they get it? It's called rape in my book. I'm still scarred from it, and I'm sure others of you, both men and women, have got scars of both physical and psychological scars that you've suffered from. It's not a joke. And John Sumple figured that out at last. And now, Free Dreamlanders, I'm asking you, we're going to give you some commercials first. I'm asking you to subscribe. You're not doing it. You're listening, and then you're tuning it out, and you're not subscribing. And I'm having trouble. We built this new website at great expense, and nobody's coming to the table. So it's time now. Come to the table now, now, now. When I first saw what The Seeding was about, I thought, oh my God, not another one. And then I saw it, and I was pretty amazed. John, when did your interest in this even begin?
Well, it started for me back in 2009. I was working with my partner in J3 Films, Jack Roth. He had asked me to help him out with a production that he was interested in doing, which is kind of like a road show throughout the Southwest, going to different hot spots and sighting spots and crash landing spots in the Southwest. And as we were kind of working through the dynamics on that, he happened to go to a Stephen Greer event in Denver, Colorado, and was introduced by Alejandro Rojas and Chuck Zukowski to the Stan Romanek story. And that was really the beginning for me. I wasn't like a dyed-in-the-wool researcher, investigator, even fanatic when it came to the research side and devouring content up until I started to work on that project with Jack in 2009.
And what about the Stan Romanek story, let me ask?
Well, it was an interesting story, you know, for us. And I've gotten in the habit of kind of defending why we did the story, because a lot of people ask and a lot of people are challenged by some of the legal issues that he's had. But, you know, we spent a lot of time with him. Him vetting us vetting him. It took us 2 years before we got to the point where we were comfortable to move forward on a project. And we spent, once that agreement was in place, we spent a lot of time, you know, with him and going through the evidence that he had. And based on what we were exposed to and what we saw while we were with him and some of the things that we experienced as a result of working on the film with him, we were convinced that there was a story worth telling. So we, you know, the story is focused on from 2000 to 2010, which is the gist of what happened to him was during that time period. But what wound up happening after the fact was when the film was debuted at the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival in 2013, we were excited about what was going to happen next, which was pitching for distribution. And right around the time we were doing the pitching was when he had that incident where he was flipping the pen cap with Peter Maxwell Slattery on a YouTube interview. And then a month later, we got a phone call saying that he had been arrested. So needless to say, we weren't very happy because
no, I wouldn't
it was
think
not
so.
Something we anticipated at all. And it changed our entire strategy with the film because nobody would touch it. And we had to go down a self-distribution route as a result of it.
And where do you come out on Stan Romanek? Because I have to admit that most of my listeners are going to be thinking that video of the alien and so forth, which a lot of people thought was faked from the beginning, mm-hmm. is not real.
And well, I guess my thoughts on that is that we spent enough time with him. And I mean, he has so much documented evidence that even if 25% of what he documented was real, one out of four things were real, he still would have more documented evidence than anybody else. So I think, you know, some of the stuff that he that happened with him was probably either government, deep state, or people just trying to make him look bad, things that happened to him. Now, Stan, our experience with him is that he never did anything that made us believe that he was not telling the truth. I mean, there are certain things that maybe he exaggerated here and there, but we really called him on everything when we were going through the process. And I think that's one of the challenges. Unless you spend the time with an individual who's had experiences, it's really hard to make judgment based on looking at, you know, a 15-second clip of an alien head popping up in a window. There was so much more to his story. And I can understand everybody that questioned it based on that, because if you're only looking at that, there's a lot of eye rolling that would have to occur because there's no substance behind it. There's no background and understanding of the story. So, hey, I get it. I know everybody that's railed against him over the years. I understand why. And I especially understand why the people who felt like he, you know, knocked himself off the pedestal with the flipping the pen cap. And then obviously with the arrest, those things are, you know, despicable to say the least, but you know, there are things that he has explanations for them. I encourage anybody to go and watch the follow-up video with Peter Maxwell Slattery, where he explains why he did what he did with that. And he, to this day, maintains his innocence as far as the charges that were held against him.
Well, you know, Wendell Stevens, of course, was also a convicted mm-hmm. child molester and interested in UFOs. I find it a kind of creepy thing that even two people in this field have been involved in that. And I just, you know, just really, when I saw that Stan Romanek's name come up in that area, I thought, my goodness. And there's a third person as well, who was not in this field exactly, but who was close to it, who got involved in that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. And of course, Wendell Stevens said it was a set up job. And I don't think that Stan Romanek ever said that. At least maybe he did initially, but then he didn't anymore. So I just
he's maintained that he was set up. He maintains that he was set up. The last that I've heard with him, he was going through treatment for cadmium poisoning, which doctors suggested it was administered to him as Good opposed God. To something that happened to
Where
him.
Is he? So, what is his situation now?
He's still in Colorado, and we don't keep, you know, in touch with him on a regular basis. And most of our communication has been through Lisa because Stan's not allowed on the internet and for legal purposes. So, you know, the last we heard was that he was going through a series of treatments for the cadmium poisoning.
Cadmium poisoning is a very serious problem.
Yeah.
Very serious. All right. Well, enough of that. We've been there and done that. We had to bring it up.
No, and it's okay. I'm used to it.
Well, Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a little break right now. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about something really quite extraordinary called the seeding. We'll be right back.
OneUnknownCountry.com subscriber says, "The subscriber offering has blossomed into an indispensable tool for my spiritual growth. Unknown Country has revitalized my sense of awe and wonder. I am very happy to participate in this exciting adventure." Listen to what another one has to say.
"I've been a subscriber to Unknown Country from almost the beginning. I get information there I can get nowhere else on the web."
And think of what you get. Commercial-free access to every Dreamland since 2004. Hundreds of special interviews. The Astonishing Meditations of Whitley Strieber. A small collection of UFO videos, but one that is rock-solid authentic, unlike so much you find elsewhere. Plus, the satisfaction of knowing that you support the best edge science website in the world.
Unknown Country, genuinely new, genuinely credible, like nothing else in the world. Subscribe today. We need you. And you'd be surprised. Once you start, you'll realize you need to be a part of this community, too. Click on that subscribe tab today.
Every week, over 30,000 people get the free unknowncountry.com newsletter. Keep up with the latest about some of the world's most amazing stories. News you cannot get elsewhere. Sign up on unknowncountry.com. We keep all email addresses strictly private. The unknowncountry.com newsletter. Unique in the world.
So you started out, talk about starting out in a difficult situation with a documentary about Stan. Then you kept at it.
Yes.
Yeah. what drew you to it? Because you're not an experience yourself, I don't believe.
No, I am not. I am not. That I'm aware of. I'm not. I don't have any recollection. No, even hints that anything has happened to me. But I think the main reason why, just a little backstory, is that when we made the first film, I saw this as kind of like my foot in the door of filmmaking, and I had tons of other ideas for films that I was interested in on the documentary side that were outside of the ufology world. And I kind of looked at that as a one and done for me. Because I didn't want to be pigeonholed. But then some things happened that made me realize that it's not about being pigeonholed, because it wasn't just about ufology for me. And what wound up happening was after the we couldn't release the Stan Romanek film through proper distribution through channels in Hollywood, we self-distributed. The film was out. We did a little bit of promotion, what we could afford. It did okay. And then 3 years later, we got a call from the Orchard distribution company in LA saying they were interested, if we were interested, in putting the film back out. And of course, we said yes. We had some money to make to pay back the people who had lended us money to make the film. So we were all in on that. Yeah. So that was a moment for us that kind of was a catalyst for everything that moved forward. Because once that film was re-released and it went through the digital distribution channels and then made it onto Netflix a few months later, it saw a whole new audience, and we were flooded with emails and social media direct messages saying, you know, along the lines of, thank you so much for making this. Now I know I'm not crazy. These things happen to me too. So I realize that I'm not alone. And that, you know, thank you so much for sharing these. I feel like I'm not, you know, that I belong, that there's other people who've had experiences just like me. So that was like over 700 messages that we received along those lines. So that was a little bit of an eye opener for me, is that there's a lot of people going through something that they weren't necessarily talking about or sharing. And some of these things were shared in confidence, saying, I've never told anybody about this before, which I'm sure you hear as well, that people, you know, they share their stories in confidence.
Communion caused an explosion.
Yeah, I'm sure. Opened a little door. Right?
Yeah, exactly. When I wrote Communion, Bud Hopkins told me he thought there were maybe 30 or 40 people involved. And that's what he thought and what I thought at the time. And then the book came out and this absolute explosion occurred worldwide.
Right.
And, you know, I've been involved with the visitors ever since. They're real and they're here.
Yeah.
And that is a very complicated issue.
It is. And once that started trickling in, we figured that we had an opportunity. Well, actually the Orchard came to us and said, well, the Romanek film did so well. It did triple the projections that they had for it, because they didn't spend a penny on advertising and promotion for it. So it was just like, we'll release it. And it just gained a ton of traction really quick. So that was a boon for us. So they came back and said, let's do this again. What are your ideas? So we talked about, you know, the film about Stan was, you know, starts with lights in the sky, moves through abduction, moves through sexual experimentation during abductions, and then to hybrid children. And we kind of led the audience to that final point towards the end, because we didn't want to, you know, scare people away. So we decided we would pick up with that in the second film and continue down a little bit deeper path and talk about the abductions for hybridization programs, and looked for people who are both male and female who had experience. It's much easier to find the females for this, which was surprising to us that there were so many people that we were pointed to and got exposed to as a result of some of the connections we had through Lori Wagner and Yvonne Smith and Chase Klotsky, who helped us connect to a bunch of people. And we wound up screening about 35, 40 people and narrowed it down to the 9 that are in the film. But we went through a process where we talked to each one of them, heard about their stories, a lot of corroboration, which was fascinating to us. But what I learned.
Multiple witness stories are pretty ordinary. We're supposed to be doing this. It's supposed to be happening to us in the dark of the night, all alone.
Right.
And we have to be hypnotized in order to remember it, preferably by somebody who isn't really a hypnotist and believes is a believer. The truth is very different as you're.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what you found.
Well, once we started having these conversations with these women, there was the pattern was very similar, that they were abducted once they had the either regressions or they started remembering things. And most of them had a significant event much older. And then when they had regressions, they remembered things dating back to when they were 5, 6, 7 years old. So there's an abduction at a young age. They're basically tagged with an implant in their uterus for monitoring purposes. Then when they become of fertile age, there's the beginning of the harvesting of eggs at, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. So from there, the eggs, you know, a couple of different scenarios that we heard was that they either extract an egg, fertilize it on craft, then abduct the person a second time and re-implant the egg. Or there's a woman will be pregnant already through traditional intercourse, and there'll be an intervention abduction, or there's a third party DNA introduced by the aliens through the abduction. So those were the two primary things that we had heard. And then, you know, the female will carry, gestate for 3-4 months, and then they wake up one day and the baby's gone. And we heard this over and over again, not just from the people that are in the film, but also several people that we interviewed that ultimately either declined not to be in the film because of personal reasons. They said, as much as I want to share my story, it could be detrimental to my relationship, to my job, to my career, to my family.
And they're right. They're right to be scared because people will, I mean, you know, to be honest with you, when I first told my story in communion, I had been raped badly. Mm-hmm. And this, in fact, to this day, I still have scar tissue from it. And when I say raped, I, what I unfortunately for me called a rectal probe, because I was too embarrassed to say I was raped. It took me 30 years to even say to my wife that word, that I had been raped. And so I had to endure 30 years of being laughed at for being raped. And that hurts. It's also, by the way, a lot of one of the reasons why a lot of men won't come forward. Sure. Because it's awful to say this and to get the guts to say it if you're a woman. But if that happened to you as a man, it's even worse because there's no recourse. You can't.
Right.
You know, a woman who's raped, we are gradually learning to care about that and to have sympathy. But when it happens to a man, it's a big joke.
Right. Right. And yeah, the whole joke around the whole anal probe thing has been forever. And it's
been going on in my life
serious.
Forever. It humiliated me, my wife, my children, my grandchildren. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable viciousness. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, some jackass from Comedy Central wanted to do a show on it. But fortunately, my agent, who knows this a lot about this at this point, said no. We won't participate
at your expense. Yeah, that's wrong.
We will not make jokes about rape, whether the man or a woman is involved. It's not funny.
It's not. It's not. And that was another seminal moment for me during the filmmaking. And one of the first three interviews that we did, one was with Neira Isley and the other one was with April Molloy, both who were in the film. Both of them used the word rape, that they were raped. They were raped physically,
which is exactly what
raped
happens.
By beings. And and when you hear that, it's shocking. And the way that April shared it, it was in some ways, Niara led us to it and we kind of knew where we were going with the conversation. But by the time we did the interview with April, when she said it, it came so far out of left field for me. I was shocked. I mean, I lost my train of thought. I was stunned by it. And I said, can we just back up for a second? You used the word rape. I just want to make sure I understood. And she goes, oh, yes, it was rape. And explain why it was rape. She says, I was penetrated against my will. I was held down. And she described, you know, being held down by a being and being, you know, the description of feeling the hands and claws and the scales of the skin and the warmth of their breath. She said it was horrid. So, and I'm not sharing this to scare people. I'm sharing this, you know, to let people know that people have been through something very traumatic. And a big message in the film, which I think you will agree, is that there needs to be more empathy and compassion for people who've been through something because it's trauma. And we're there for people who've been through things that are traumatic, like a loss of a loved one, a divorce or a breakup, anything that is traumatic, depression. We support people who've been through difficult things, but this has been such a taboo for such a long time. We think it's about time that people heard about what happens to the people who've been through UFO experiences and not just focus on the lights in the sky.
Well, you know, it's such a mixed bag, though, because, I mean, I'm a mixed bag. I have had absolutely peak experiences in this and the worst experience of my life also. Mm-hmm. And it gets much, I mean, there's stuff I haven't even ever written about that I will never write about because I can't.
Too personal. Yeah.
It's deeply, deeply personal. I've even written about being made love with by one of these beings, but there's more. I mean, there's even more than that. And I'm not alone. That's probably every person you talked to did not tell you their whole story, would be my guess.
I would assume so. Yeah.
I would, because there's something else. There's other stuff going on. And you have to wonder why something that could be so marvelous is also so awful. It's just so mysterious.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things that we kind of, and there's no one knows the answers. There's so much more to learn. And that's one of the themes in the film about the expanding circles that from Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay on circles, that every time we expand the circle of knowledge and awareness and breakthroughs, there's so many more questions to ask. It doesn't mean we've solved anything. It just means we've opened up Pandora's box for a whole bunch of new questions that will take us further and further into the exploration process. And I think that's where we are with this, is that, we're learning that there's multiple races, there's multiple agendas, and we just don't know, not necessarily who all the good ones are and who all the bad ones are. And some experiences are beautiful that people have talked about. They've been shown amazing things.
We also, the other thing that always troubles me is we don't know in the bad experiences, and I'm always tarred and feathered by saying people say, oh, well, he soft pedals everything. Ha ha. They don't read my books. But in any case, we don't know if what troubles me about this is if you take a little kitten to the vet, the kitten is terrified and has a horrible experience. But you save the kitten's life.
Right.
So we don't know what's going on. That's what bothers me. We can't, we can't say this is bad. We can only say it's really horrible to experience.
Right. And I think the big thing with that, though, is that we're so ingrained into the earthbound paradigm. The bubble of our knowledge is contained unless we're willing to break outside of that to create a different type of awareness. And, what we know and how we kind of look at everything that happens in our lives is that we're in control. That we've got it all figured out when we really only know as much as we know. There may be so much more that we don't know. And that's the thing I think that hinders us from making major steps forward within the whole idea of we're not alone. And where do we fit into an intergalactic, multidimensional, multiverse reality? We don't know because we've never journeyed there. And until we do, we're not going to know where all of the dominoes fall.
Anne used to say, they could tell us. They could explain it.
Right.
And they don't. There's no explanation given. And it happens in the middle of the night unexpectedly, and you can't stop it. So one thing I can be sure of, that even if this is something that ultimately is for our own betterment, they could be a little bit more forthcoming about what they're doing.
Yes, I would agree with that. Well, one of the things that we're actually already shot the third film, which is we're going to go a little bit further, not into the abduction story, but why is it all happening? And what are the belief paradigms? So there's a little bit of a historical take in the next film. And then we explore the three different paradigms in particular, the religious paradigm, biblical paradigm, the ascension paradigm, and then the colonization paradigm. Three very, very different outcomes, but all believe in beings navigating craft for the purpose of abducting people, having reproductive experiments, and then hybrid children. Everybody in those three different groups believes the exact same thing, but the end games are very, very different. So there is a lot of belief around this in various parts of our culture, but with very, very different reasons and very different approaches and how they look at it. So we want to explore that a little more with the sole purpose of getting people to realize that, there are a lot more people in the world that are exposed to this, and you probably realize, and if we all started talking about it and sharing stories, we may get a little bit further to that moment of clarity than we are right now.
Well, we're far from it. So you've ended up sort of on a mission.
Yes. Unbeknownst to me.
Right.
I mean, it has become something of a journey. Yes.
Of course. And those of us in this experience think that there's no such thing as an accident in it. It all happens for a reason. And here you are, the seeding is the best thing that's ever been done in this field. in my opinion, on the abduction phenomenon. And folks, if tell us where to find it, how to do, where are we going to watch it, be able to watch
it? First of all, coming from you, that's the highest compliment.
I've watched really it, folks. It. I've watched. I'm not. I'm asking him to tell you where you can watch it.
The best place to go is to our the film's website, extraordinarytheseating.com, and there are links within that page to all the different formats that the film is currently available. So it's available for digital download right now. We just encourage people to drop by the website. There's some information there. And one other thing I do want to kind of give attention to is that, three things in the film was to create awareness, to encourage empathy and compassion, and to facilitate community for people who've had experiences. And one of the things that is included in the website is on our J3 Films website, and it's a link at the end of the film, says to visit J3Films.com/support. And there's a website that we are looking at more as a beginning journey of being a resource page. So I encourage anybody who's had experiences to go to that page. And if anybody who is helping experiencers, to let us know so that we can add you to that resource list.
Yeah. So listen to what he's saying, folks, because this is where you are and you're listening now. And if there's any place in the world where there are a lot of experiences involved, it's this place.
Yes.
So do definitely listen to it. And so you really have got more coming. And now, are you self-distributing the seating as well?
No, we actually signed an agreement with The Orchard. Now,
with The Orchard. Oh, I see. So you're making this for The Orchard. I see.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We have a five-year deal with them. So our goal is, we've got 1 year down. We've got 4 more years left. And our goal is to do a film a year.
Wow. That's fabulous. So you've got a lot coming.
A lot of work. Yeah, we have one that's we're in post-production now. We've got 2 other ones that are in kind of development stage. I wouldn't even say they've made it to pre-production, but they're in development. So we've got a lot more comes to us every time we talk about this too. So I would say that over the last 3 or 4 weeks, we've had a handful of people reach out to us with their stories, which I think is encouraging.
Yeah, because there's a lot of stories out there. Gosh, yeah, I mean, Annie collected thousands upon thousands of letters, and they're now all archived at Rice University. Mm-hmm. So, those people wrote, this is before email and before the internet had sort of caused the human mind to kind of disappear into itself. It's such a strange way that we haven't yet figured out. Well, thank you so much for being with us and spending this time with us on Dreamland. This is important stuff, folks. Let's just repeat now. The show is, film is called The Seeding. And tell us again exactly where we can get it.
Yeah, visit extraordinarytheseeding.com. And there's a trailer is there, as well as links to the different platforms, digital platforms, where you can watch it.
It's extraordinarytheseeding.com. That's extraordinarytheseeding.com. And you should definitely go there and take a look at it. I think it's really a fine effort. And John, it's been an honor to have you on Dreamland.
Thank you very much.
Say yes to serious wonder. Unknown Country offers so much. Free Dreamland, a free weekly newsletter, free daily news, a thriving free message board. But it all depends on you becoming a subscriber. And you get so much more. Dreamland and special interview archives going back years. Vintage Dreamland from the broadcast days. Live chats with our extraordinary guests. So say yes to serious wonder. Click on that subscribe tab on Unknown Country today.
The key, the mystery, the wonder. Now in a powerful new edition from Tarcher Penguin. Whitley Strieber updates the thrilling story with new revelations. Even the master of the key's most incredible predictions are coming true. We've discovered that there are many universes besides our own. He predicted this in 1998. He described how intelligent machines could be built. We're doing it now. If you love The Key, you need this new edition. And if you've never read it before, don't miss this beautiful book filled with true wisdom and true revelations. The Key is unique in this world. Graham Hancock says, consider its messages, and you'll find it has worked a kind of magic on you. The Key, a selection of the Quality Paperback Book Club, the Book of the Month Club, and the One Spirit Book Club. Available in paperbacks everywhere and online in all ebook formats. There are hundreds of charitable organizations in the world, but you have to have a sharp eye to be sure your money is going to where it's needed and not into the pockets of overpaid administrators. That's why Whitley Strieber and UnknownCountry.com support the Mercy Corps. It's non-sectarian, it's lean and efficient, and it goes everywhere on earth that people are in need. When you contribute, you can be sure that most of your dollar goes right to the homeless, the starving, and the desperate. Go to Unknown Country and click on the Mercy Corps Foundation ad on the left side of your homepage. A $10 gift can put food on a child's plate and shoes on his feet. Unknown Country and Whitley Strieber receive no compensation from the Mercy Corps.
Last week, we talked to Andrew Collins about the European aspect of the huge new book, Denis of an Origins, that he has written with Greg Little. This week, we are going to go into the American side of it. Greg is a real expert on this. He is an author of over 30 books. He's written the Encyclopedia of Native American Indian Mounds and Earthworks. He's done Edgar Cayce's Atlantis and many, many other books. He's been on Dreamland quite a few times over the years, most recently in 2014, talking about an extraordinary discovery about the spiritual aspects of the mounds and the mound builder culture. Now, as you know, as I said earlier during the introduction, I have had the most powerful experience of my life, and it happened on a Native American reservation, the Pine Ridge Reservation of the Lakota Sioux. And while I'm not going to talk about that today, Greg, if you will, before we get into the Denisovan material, which itself is brain-bending, let's talk about another brain-bender, which is the spiritual aspect of the mound builder culture, because I found out myself a few weeks ago that the spiritual power of these people is still really alive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is. First of all, thanks a lot for having me on, Whitley.
My pleasure.
And I did not know that you had spent time at Pine Ridge. That has got to be, it is two opposites. It is one of the saddest places on earth, of course, because of the Wounded Knee Massacre. But it's also one of the most intriguing places around because it is a center, a spiritual center. Native Americans had a drastically different view of the world and the spiritual world. And for many, many years, actually, they still do. Archaeologists and anthropologists have derided their belief system as animism. That is, they believe everything is alive. Well, that is not exactly what their belief was. Their belief is that everything is spiritual in its nature. The mound builders in particular looked at like dirt or earth as the most primordial substance of spirit. It is part of the spiritual world. And they recognized that our bodies came from the earth. And that is partly why they would cremate bodies after death to return them, that spiritual being or that spiritual life, back to the earth. But that wasn't our only soul. They saw that we had a life soul, which was made out of the earth, but we also had a energy soul, which they called the free soul, because it got free of the body. And then it made a transition to the sky to the upper world or the stars. And we can get in that if you want to later. But their spiritual belief system was that everything was spiritual. Everything came from the same source, and it was all different manifestations. For example, water is flowing spirit. Electricity that they would see from lightning, actually, that was the free use of energy by the Thunderbird, but it was still spiritual in nature. Rocks were solidified spirit, and the most pure form of spirit, condensed spirit, were crystals. And of course, crystal magic or crystal, you can call them tricks or whatever you want to, but they saw that crystals embedded a huge amount of spiritual energy and used under the right circumstances could create really powerful experiences. And that's actually how I got into all this to begin with. I was interested in their spiritual experiences, and initially my real focus was on the electromagnetic and electrical effects on brain chemistry and how the brain chemistry then might produce experiences. Subtle energy is a term that is used in some areas of physics and biology that look at this, but we are definitely affected by the electromagnetic forces around us. So earthworks and mounds fit into this because mounds and earthworks create sort of a pathway through different kinds of electromagnetic forces. So that's kind of a summary. Their belief system is a lot deeper than anything that I've said, but they believed that we had two souls. One was tied to the physical world. It needed to be returned to the earth after death. And there's an exception, of course. The exception is if you want the being to reincarnate, then you interred them in a tomb. But there's actually very few of those in the Native American world here. Most mounds did contain burials. At least the conical mounds did, and a lot of times the burials were the remains from cremations because they would make massive bonfires, have the bodies on them after preparation, and then after the cremation was over, they would sometimes make the mound bigger and then do it again and again. But that was a way to return the physical body back to its spiritual essence. But again, there was a free soul that then was released, and it made a transition to the sky world.
Which is very similar in many ways to Egyptian mythology, and I shouldn't really call it mythology because I'm pretty sure now that it is actual, that we're talking about something real.
Well, I believe it is too.
Now, I want to go just briefly back all the way to the first real religious text that we have, which is the pyramid text in the Pyramid of Unas in Egypt that dates back to, I believe, about 4000 BC. And it contains a description of the spine as a serpent.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea is reflected, I think, in the serpent mound.
It may very well be.
Yeah.
These effigy mounds, there, serpent mound is the largest of all the American effigy mounds. And effigy mounds usually depicted some sort of animal form, but there are several different types of these serpent mounds. Some are made out of stone, and like in Alabama, there's several. But the serpent mound in Ohio is massive, and it may very well relate to Kundalini energy or this energy like the similar thing that the Egyptians believed in. Now, Graham Hancock's new book called America Before actually goes into great depth into the Egyptian connection to this. And, of course, back in 2014, Andrew and I, in the book Path of Souls, we simply mentioned in passing that these beliefs are almost identical to those the Egyptians held. And that's an interesting thing in itself. All this appears to have been an ancient worldwide belief system. And that's actually astonishing, since mainstream archaeologists have said for years that all of these cultures developed on their own and developed their belief systems on their own, and it really doesn't make sense then why they would all come to the same conclusion unless there's something else at work here other than random coincidence.
And they are pretty mean about it, too.
Oh, my
God. I mean,
the vitriol that they spew, that a few of them spew, is just unbelievable. And even with this book Andrew and I just did, I've read two really, I'd call them negative reviews, one by an archaeologist and the other by a skeptic who I won't even talk about. But neither one of them addressed any of the specifics at all. One of them simply said that it was all paranoid BS. I won't say the word, the second word, but he spelled it out, which is absolutely bizarre to me. There's no paranoia.
Well, folks, let me put it this way.
Yeah.
There is no paranoia whatsoever in Denisovan Origins. It is not a conspiracy theory book at all.
I know. Well, they're projecting. As a psychologist, I can say that there's projection at work. They are, what's really happened here in the past few years, archaeology, mainly mainstream academic archaeology, is being exposed, that they have been perpetrating for decades, at least 70 years, something that they've said is factual and absolutely scientific, and it's not. And it's been uncovered by their own people and shown to be false, and some of them are just simply upset about it. So some of them are paranoid, and that's why I think this person wrote those words about it, because I think that person is projecting, and it's projecting. Projection is a psychological term, and it simply means they themselves are paranoid, and they're projecting that on other people, and that then allows them to say whatever they want to say negatively. But no, there's no paranoia in it at all.
No.
It just lays out facts.
It lays out facts, and that's the problem for them.
Yeah.
Because the facts it lays out are absolutely remarkable and very different from their timeline. And they're basically, what you're looking at here are people who are in a state of denial. They are, first of all, anesthetized to the existence of their own souls. And this makes them really unable to understand what these people were and how they thought, because they were not only not anesthetized to their own souls, this was what their world was about.
Yeah.
It was about living through a life on behalf of your soul's eventual journey.
Yeah.
And this is what we've lost, and this is why one of the visitors once told Betty Andreas, and children of the northern peoples wander in eternal darkness. Mm. The darkness is soul denial.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I know that these people are atheists. They do not like anything that says there is a soul. They don't even like it when you talk about it, say, intellectually. Like, you know, if you're an anthropologist and you want to say, oh, the Native Americans believe there was a soul and this, unless you say it's a silly, stupid belief, the skeptics get upset. They do not want anything at all in support of the idea of us having an afterlife, a soul, a spiritual world, or any of that. They also don't like anything that uses the word giants. I've actually written a couple of articles that go into that in depth, why they even deny all these 7-foot skeletons. And the reason is because they think it relates to either creationism or ancient aliens. And they don't want a single thing that supports the Bible or supports anything ancient aliens says. And it's true, ancient aliens gets out there. They dabble on the fringes. But it's probably one of the best things for people to see actual archaeology sites. Otherwise, they wouldn't see this stuff.
Yeah, they dabble on the fringes. But the problem is, the mainstream is so far, so deeply lost,
rigid,
that there's nothing left you can do if you want to try to understand yourself and your past.
That's right. And you can't question any of the status quo. And they've done that to themselves. That's actually in that part, in the part of the Denisovan Origins that I did, to me, the most interesting part of the entire book is South America.
Well, let's now wait a minute. We've got to take a break for Free Dreamlanders. And when we come back, we're going to go to South America. We'll be right back.
Ever wonder what the close encounter experience is all about? Think you know what it's about? When you open Whitley and Ann Strieber's Immortal Communion Letters, you're going to experience a whole new vision. Not something being told to us by researchers and theorists, but the actual testimony of people who came face to face with this unknown. Unforgettable. And the book is only $3.99 at Strieber.com.
This is Whitley Strieber. I'll be at the Portal to Ascension Conference October 4th to the 6th, 2019. Go to ascensionconference.com to find out more. It's going to be a really good show. Michael Tellinger will be there. JJ and Desiree Hertok, Travis Walton, and of course, yours truly. I'll be talking about A New World, the new book that I am bringing out, as well as ongoing contacts with Anne, who is still very much part of this whole operation. Incredibly. What a life. Don't miss me at the Portal to Ascension Conference. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com. Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world. Help keep us on the air by subscribing to unknowncountry.com today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab. Dreamland, where wonder is spoken.
Talking to Greg Little. This is our second week on Denisovan Origins, Hybrid Humans, Göbekli Tepe, and the Genesis of the Giants of Ancient America by Andrew Collins and Gregory Little. Okay, Greg, let's roll. We're going down to South America right now.
Well, okay, back around 1520, long time ago, not that many years after Columbus reached the Bahamas, in 1520, Magellan, the famous Magellan, tried to find a way around South America so he could get to Asia. Well, the weather was so bad that Magellan's into all of his ships that he had, they landed on the southernmost tip of South America, which is called, the whole area is called Patagonia, and it was actually Magellan that named it. And Patagonia, by the way, supposedly means big feet. And that's actually interesting because of the giants that Magellan reported. But they stayed there for an entire winter. During the time that they were there, they saw, Magellan actually had this in his logs, and it was his chroniclers that wrote it down too. They always had several. He was a meticulous keeper of notes and details. Magellan wrote that there were natives there, native warriors, when they first arrived, standing on the beach, that were 9 to 10 feet in height. Now, his men got on shore and actually had some battles with some of them. Eventually, the giants, and I'm using the term giant in that a 9-foot person would definitely be a giant to almost anybody listening to this. Even a 7-foot human today would think somebody 9 feet tall is a giant.
And that would work, certainly.
Yeah, they weren't tall and skinny. These were proportionally built people. So Magellan actually knew and wrote that nobody would ever believe this. So they captured two of them and put them on the boat and started back to Europe. And on the way back, both of these large people or natives got sick and they died. And they decided on the way back, it took them over a month, they dumped the bodies overboard. But it was all written about. So then a series of other captains, people like Lord Byron, many others, the last person there that was there was Charles Darwin, and we'll get to that in a minute. But many captains went there. They unfortunately discovered gold, but after one sea captain after another, some of them were military, they encountered what they all called giants. And there were two tribes there. One was called the Ona, and the other was the Toluche. These tribes, most of them were 7 feet tall. Some of them were taller than that. All of the sea captains saw them. All of their men saw them. It was written up again and again and again. However, around the year 1800, an effort to exterminate them took place. And that effort to exterminate them culminated the time that Darwin was there around 1850 or so. I think it was 1846 Darwin was there. Darwin wrote about it extensively. There were then only a couple of the Ona tribe left and a handful of the Toluches, as they had killed all the others. Now, the reason that the Europeans were trying to kill them, this was a mixture of many different European groups, Spanish, the Portuguese, and some of the English, but it was mainly the Spanish and the Portuguese. It was because they were searching for gold, and the tribes were not really allowing them to go into the regions and search in their areas, and they saw that it was a good sheep herding country, so they started sheep herding. So they decided they would simply kill them all off. So every time sea captains went from there on, the people got shorter and shorter until there were none left. Darwin witnessed battles where dozens of these people were killed at a time. Darwin said the ones that were left were 6 feet, 6 inches in height, which in 1848 was still an astonishing height, average height, for any group of people. At that time, people were about 5'5", 5'6", in height on average. So we know this occurred in South America, and that's why I think it is the most interesting. And this is the extreme South American point. Tierra del Fuego is a very large triangular-shaped island down there, and it had these two groups. Now, archaeologists for years, you'll see this in little notes and sidebars and in textbooks, they'll talk about it. If you'll get on Wikipedia, you can read a statement about it on Wikipedia, and it's just unbelievable. The Europeans mistakenly believed that they were tall. That's what it basically says. Because they were taller than a few of them, the European explorers and sailors were mistaken that they thought they were tall. And so, and then they'll say that any other reports are simply exaggerations. The same thing has been applied to the 50 or so skeletons that were more than 7 feet in height that were pulled out of North American Indian mounds by archaeologists working for the Smithsonian, the Carnegie Institute, also for the University of Kentucky. There's a number of other schools that they worked for, all mainstream archaeologists, and modern skeptics say that they either mismeasured, they exaggerated, or it's a hoax. That is it. They don't accept any of it. And they have sanitized Wikipedia. There is an actual group called the Wiki Skeptics. They are in control of all these sites on Wikipedia. You cannot make changes to these sites when they're on them. They lock them. And they sanitized it. There are no legitimate seven-footers ever found, according to them. And they just simply deny it. Yet there's mainstream archaeology articles about it. The most recent one I discovered quite serendipitously, and it was around the time that Andrew and I talked to you in an automobile after we'd gone through what we called the Valley of the Giants. We went to a place in Arkansas, Jonesboro, Arkansas, it's Blytheville, Arkansas, where a mound called Chickasaba was. Now, Chickasaba was on the old Blytheville Air Force Base, and that's where they kept the B-52. So it was all fenced off starting in the 70s or so, and then people quit digging into it. But out of that mound, dozens of 7 to 8 feet tall skeletons were pulled. The most recent one was in the 70s. Now, two archaeologists, and this became important to me because one of the archaeologists that wrote the report, one of these two, was a professor of mine at Memphis State University in the 70s. These two archaeologists found it astonishing. They went to the Chicago Field Museum, where the only remains that were pulled out of the mound were kept. They measured all of the skeletal remains that were left and calculated on the average that the last one pulled out was 8 feet, 6 inches in height out of this mound. Now, they also said, okay, we'll reduce it by a huge amount because of possible errors. They don't even say what those are. And they said, okay, it couldn't have been any less than 7 feet, 4 inches in height, but it was probably 8 feet, 6 inches in height. Yet all of these things, even written in mainstream archaeology journals. That was published in the Arkansas Archaeologist, which is a peer-reviewed journal. They claim all of it is either hoax or it is mismeasuring or it's an exaggeration by the authors or the person that found it. Now, I'm not talking about all the newspaper articles that others might mention. A lot of the newspaper articles were, in fact, exaggerations or just people didn't know. But I'm talking only about the reports that were published in mainstream academic journals, and we just ignored the rest. Yet they deny all those, too. It's just astonishing to me.
Well, yeah, it is astonishing, and it's infuriating in a way, too, because we're not getting the whole story. And, in fact, we're not getting the real story, which is basically about a people and a world which was still connected to the planet. And the Native Americans, I mean, I went to a ritual on Pine Ridge. Incredible power. This was real sacred dance.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary, ancient ritual. And the power was power coming from the planet. You could feel it right in your body. The earth is I'm going to say this. You don't have to. You've got enough trouble with archaeologists going down this path. But I think the earth is a conscious being, and we are denying that consciousness, which is why our world as we know it is falling apart around our ears at every level.
Well, I have come to believe that everything has a form of consciousness. And yes, the earth would be a system of it. I actually do believe that.
Absolutely.
A lot of psychologists and biologists will agree with that.
And an increasingly large number of physicists.
Yes.
But when you get into these sort of old-fashioned disciplines like archaeology, which has got a long, very Eurocentric tradition, we are the best.
Yeah.
You know, we are the ones who really know the truth, and these other people were all very silly.
I think the North American archaeologists just took right up with that. You know, and if in the book I talked about the battle between the North American archaeologists and the South American archaeologists.
There's a huge difference between the two, for sure.
Oh,
but go ahead.
It's a huge difference. North American archaeologists and I got this from articles in Spanish that South American archaeologists wrote. They said that the North American people hang on to the idea that we were first. That is, the first people were always in North America, and it's a prize of some kind.
And it's like not true. And in the next part of the show, we've got about 4 minutes left in this part of the show, but we're going to talk about exactly why South American archaeologists would say that, because it's incredible. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, they say it because of bias. Most of the South American archaeologists that have found sites that predate anything in North America, they're women and they're Hispanic, and they have their PhDs from South American archaeology schools.
Which, where you talk about a number of strikes against them.
Yeah.
Women, Hispanic, and North American.
Yeah, they didn't go to school here. And for years, they had to be very careful because almost all of their funding came from North America. North American archaeology remains dominated by actually older white males. Now, I'm an older white male, and that in and of itself, I don't think is anything. It doesn't really mean anything. However, North American archaeology, there's been a stranglehold on it from the very beginning by older white males, and that remains today.
And from a couple of universities, isn't that?
It's a handful. It's only a small group of people that really control most of the funding, and the funding and the university positions are all that matter. And if you can't get funding, you basically have to move on to a different field. There aren't many academic jobs in it, so it's a very constrained field. Not a lot to win in mainstream archaeology, so if you've got an academic job, you're not going to do anything or say anything that jeopardizes your position. So going against the mainstream can jeopardize, and that's one of the issues. South America has no such issues down there. They just find stuff and they report it, They have used, they've used the U.S. Geological Survey to do a lot of their dating. They've used the Max Planck Institute in Germany to do their dating. They've used France's top-of-the-line dating services like carbon dating and uranium thorium. And their dates are incredible of when the first people were here. The Americas were inhabited a long, long time ago, probably 300,000 years ago at least. And that is solid data out of South America. If you read the American archaeologist's response to that data when it came out, it's pretty clear here. It's really simple. They say people did not have the ability to cross the oceans then, so it's impossible. And there were no modern humans then, so it's impossible. It can't be, therefore it isn't. And it didn't matter what the evidence was they found. It didn't matter what the dating was that they found. It's just not possible according to their belief system. So it was all rejected out of hand. And there's not just one finding like this. There are many. There's at least 15 to 20 sites in South America that are 50,000 years ago or more. None of that is accepted by North American archaeologists, and they avoid discussing it. They will not discuss it. That's why even the skeptics that read our book and wrote about it, the mainstream archaeologist that did, he didn't discuss one idea that the book proposed.
Not one.
Single one. He just said Andrew's part was written in a very different style than my part, my second part.
Oh, well, that's a surprise. I can't see how you could have managed that. Okay, we have come to the end of Free Dreamland, folks. We're going deep into some truly wondrous material. One of the reasons that we don't know who we are is that we dropped the thread. When I was on Pine Ridge, I was with people, some of the poorest people in the world, certainly the poorest people in North America, but they had not dropped the thread. And there was a whole new world there, a whole new world. And we're going to go back into the past now with Greg and explore that world as it was when it was alive, what happened to it, what it meant, and how right now we can pick up the thread. We don't have to wander in eternal darkness. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for being with us. I hope you join this. Subscribe, because as I say all the time, if you don't, eventually I'm going to run out of money. And right now, the subscriptions are at an new subscriptions are at an all-time low. Thank you anyway for being with us.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.